The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we
because
have main
they are
engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good morning, listeners, and welcome to the Friday Space Show. I am your host, David Livingston. Great to be back, and thank you all for tuning in. Let's run through the announcements. We'll do it quickly, and then on to our discussion with Michael Belfiore. Please write down our toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screeners. Let the phone ring until it can be answered. We'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible, and I will hold you over a break. Yeah, so don't let an upcoming break stop you from using the telephone. And then if you insist on doing email, it is drspace@thespaceshow.com, thespaceshow@gmail.com, and dmlivings@yahoo.com. Please do remember we're copyrighted and trademarked. You can download shows and share them and pass them around and copy them. Please don't do anything commercial. Don't do any editing of the programs. And if you have any ideas of what you'd like to do with this or that program, please contact me. I'm interested in hearing from you. We also thank Gigadial. They do our podcasting. Special thanks goes to Andrew. And you'll find the RSS URL on both of our newsletters and on our website. Please do remember we're in iTunes, and you'd search for The Space Show or my name. Podcast Alley, Yastro.com, a host of other places, including we are now on Zune, Z-U-N-E. And you can find the direct URL for Zune for a while. I'll leave it up on the website newsletter just before we start telling you what's involved with the programs for the week. And also in South America, astrospacenow.com. So if you have any problems or questions with our podcast, please do get a hold of us, and we'll do our best to respond to you and answer your questions. Do visit our website, which is thespaceshow.com. Remember that our comprehensive newsletter is on that website. Just scroll down a little bit and you'll see it. You can't miss it. It has all of the details of the week's programs on it. It has a future events section, and it also has all of the guest bios. Plus, if we have to make a change in weekly programming or get an announcement out to you, this is where you're going to find it first. So do check it from time to time. And if you want to subscribe to the very short email newsletter that goes out early Monday morning by email, then go ahead and send your request to drspace@thespaceshow.com. Everything we do is archived. You can listen right off of our website or easily download these shows. There's a Space Show store on our website. Please check it out. It's up at the top. It's called Space Show Gear. And then you'll see the Support the Space Show button. Remember, we're a 501c3 nonprofit with the One Giant Leap Foundation. And we can't do this program without your contributions and support. And for those of you who pay United States taxes, you do get a tax deduction. If you also pay California taxes, if you live in the once golden state, you also get a California deduction, as we're a California public benefit corporation. And if you have any questions about One Giant Leap Foundation, check it out at their website, onegiantleapfoundation.org, or send me an email, and we'll move forward on that. Do note that we do have the blog up and running, and you're welcome to post comments and questions about each and every show. And that blog URL is http://thespaceshow.wordpress.com. And then my final reminder is that The Space Show is partially brought to you by the Secure World Foundation, promoting cooperative solutions for space security. For more information, visit thesecureworldfoundation.org. And now it's a great pleasure to introduce to you Michael Belfiore, who is returning to the Space Show. If you're not reading his blog, or if you don't get his newsletter, or if you don't read his articles that come out from time to time in Popular Science and in other publications, you're missing out on some of the best information available in the space community. His bio is up on the website because he has been a guest many, many times before, and it's also on the newsletter and will certainly be up when we archive this show. But he does also have several books that we've talked about on the Space Show, Life Aboard a Space Station, Rocketeers, How a Visionary Band of Business Leaders, Engineers, and Pilots is Boldly Privatizing Space. And then he had a book that we talked about last year about DARPA. It's probably one of the only books I know of about DARPA. It's called The Department of Mad Scientists, How DARPA is Remaking Our World, From the Internet to Artificial Limbs. Michael, welcome back to the Space Show. How you doing?
Hi, good. Thanks, David. Thanks for having me back.
Do you have any new books in the works?
No, right now I'm kind of seeing what's going on. I'm going to conferences, visiting different places and companies, gathering article ideas. It's kind of the incubation process to see what's next. I mean, there's so much amazing things going on right now in the technology realm that
so
it's hard to know where to begin.
You cover more than just space, correct?
Yeah, I really went from space with Rocketeers into DARPA by way of space, because DARPA started out as the nation's first space agency, but they are into all kinds of stuff, and that got me really interested in some of their subject areas, one of which is energy, which I'm pretty excited about right now. I think we're in a big turning point in that area now.
Oh, tell us about what are we going to turn toward?
Well, there's so many different places to go, and that's partly what's exciting about it. We've been so dependent on one or two sources of energy for most of the industrial age. I mean, it's all mostly variations of coal. We have some nuclear, too, but, you know, 80% of the electricity generated in this country is from coal, and, of course, we drive our cars mostly on petroleum. Well, that's changing a little bit. So I think what we're going toward now is more of a portfolio of solutions that are really going to change the way we use energy and where we get it and what we have to do to get it and hopefully make the world a better place.
Where does space solar power fit into this, or does it?
I think it could in the future. I mean, I talked about that at the end of Rocketeers. I devoted a chapter to it, basically. I think we're not quite there yet. I mean, I think we need more affordable launch solutions. I mean, even Elon Musk, you know, the head of SpaceX, he actually laughed at me when I called him to ask him about space solar power and how that fit in.
Well, he's not a supporter of it in any way whatsoever.
No, he thinks that even with the economies of scale that he's envisioning for his company, and hopefully the competition that will come along too, that it's still not going to be affordable. But I think it's inevitable eventually that it will be somewhere in the mix. But I think ground-based solar power has a lot of potential, and Elon Musk does too. Of course, he has a big stake in Solar City out in California, installing solar on the ground.
Yeah, to be fair, we should say that he is in a competing terrestrial solar industry and business. But I happen to think he's correct on that. But this is the space show, so at least let's sort of start out with space and see where we go. So the last time you were on was about the DARPA book. Lots has happened in space policy, NASA, civil space programs like Constellation are likely dead. Shuttle's about to go. So from your perspective, where are we? What's happening? What do you see for NASA and for the civil space program?
I think we're at a big turning point. I think whatever happens with NASA, and it's still not clear what's going on, because Congress is still holding back the policy that Obama set last year, that, you know, we're going to start hiring private companies like SpaceX to service the space station. And owning and operating government vehicles is no longer going to be, you know, the only means of sending astronauts to low Earth orbit. But, of course, Congress has to sign off on that, and there's so much money at stake for so many people and companies in so many states that it's not at all clear where it's going or where the policy is going to end up. But I think the cat's out of the bag now. It's inevitable. There's no stopping it now. I mean, SpaceX proved in December that they could fly a capsule, first time a private company has ever flown a capsule large enough to carry astronauts into orbit and then landed it successfully, which right there was a tremendous achievement. I mean, they came down, I think, within half a mile of their target. And, you know, they didn't need a flotilla of Navy vessels to find it and pick it up, as Gene Cernan testified that they would in Senate hearings. So I was really glad to see that all come off, you know, without a hitch. And I think that at this point, SpaceX is so far along that they're not going to stop, no matter what NASA does. And eventually we'll have a time when there'll just be no other reasonable option but to hire a company like SpaceX to send astronauts up there and you know, whatever happens to Orion and Constellation and all those older programs that have, you know, they're billions of dollars into the hole, it won't matter.
Yeah, it's interesting. SpaceX has accomplished what only other nation states have accomplished.
Yeah, I think
for a fraction of the cost.
Something like six countries have done that. Yeah, and you know, they're saying about $800 million from, you know, empty warehouse, which for me is just incredible to see. I mean, I started following them around 2004, and you know, visited their old plant out near where they are now. It's in El Segundo, California. Just a small warehouse. They moved a few blocks away to this massive 747 vehicle assembly building. And just to see what these folks have done, actually, you know, moving to a different paradigm, I think that's what it is a paradigm shift from very expensive one-off vehicles to something that approaches mass production. And something that can create economies of scale. I mean, you go in there and you just see rows of rocket engines being built. I mean, they're gonna be the largest manufacturer of rocket engines in the world, I think, pretty soon.
For at least for now, and maybe the foreseeable future, the primary customer is still government. You know, and they do have the telecommunications satellite contract coming up. Are you seeing, are you detecting an emergence of new business opportunities and real commercial opportunities beyond the talk or the rhetoric or the PowerPoint stage?
You know, I think it's still, for better or for worse, I think it's still up to the government to be the main customer right now. I think the other customers will follow, but it's awfully hard to invest in a company, you know, if you're an investor. But without a personal stake in it, you know, like you and I have this passion for space, but people who are going to throw lots of money into an investment want to see a proven customer and a proven way to make money, even if it's a risky way. And right now, the main customer is still the government. So, you know, there still is this relationship there that has to be fruitful on some level. You know, if some kind of funding goes into commercial space efforts from NASA, it's going to help the industry tremendously. I mean, the flip side of that, though, is that if policy changes or new leadership comes in and feels differently than the one we have, then that could all go south. So I don't think it's quite a done deal yet on the government side. I do think, like I said, I do think that even if NASA pulls back, it will still happen. It is still inevitable. I think people like Elon Musk have enough of their own resources and commitment to make it happen, even without the government. But it might take longer, and who knows what twists and turns that we'll have to go through to get there.
Your first question is coming from our friend Todd in San Diego, who is frequently with us by email on these shows. Todd, you ought to pick up the phone and call in. But anyway, Todd says there was a January 31st New York Times article that talked about the very strong likelihood of the commercial crew program being cut in half, maybe even more, especially the upfront costs, which were going to be $6 billion over 5 years. And members of the Senate and Congress are saying that's never going to happen. although they're not giving any real details. At the end of the article, there was an interview comment by the CEO of Orbital, and they were talking about future demand and business opportunities. And he said words to the effect that it's just not there yet, and he doesn't expect to see it. I would urge everybody to get a hold of the article. Unfortunately, I don't have the name of the article in front of me, but it was January 31st in the New York Times, written by someone named Chang. Do you have any comments about that? Have you seen that article? Or do you have any thoughts about commercial crew being cut significantly in the fiscal year 11 budget?
Yeah, I missed that article, but I'm familiar with the craziness that's going on here. And we've got the president setting a policy that Congress doesn't want to go along with, or at least not to the extent where it's going to be an unequivocal, leadership behind it. And I don't see the president getting personally behind it either. So, we're sort of there. I mean, the right words are there to get it to happen, but I think we don't have the real leadership we need to really push it through. So who knows what's going to happen? But I think Elon Musk is going to do what it takes. I mean, he's committed himself and his fortune to make this happen. And then we also have Robert Bigelow with a similar conviction, commitment, creating the destinations. Of course, he's creating the first commercial orbital habitat. With those two guys, I mean, I hate to see this whole thing hanging on a couple of guys, but these guys seem to me they're real leaders out there, and people like Orbital and Boeing, I think, are going to be the followers. They're not going to commit serious resources of their own until they see some money coming in from NASA or somewhere else. So I think it's going to be up to the Bigelows and the Musks of the world to get it going. And if there's money from NASA, that's great. Like I say, I think it's going to make it go faster, but I think even without that, I think we can still get there.
And I just found the article that our listener was talking about. So for those of you, I'll go ahead and put it in the archive write-up of the show. But it's from January 31st. He was right about that. The headline is Businesses Take Flight with Help from NASA. The author is Kenneth Chang, and it has a picture of Dream Chaser on the beginning of the article, and the dateline is Boulder, Colorado, at a testing facility near the University of Colorado. So you can find it and check it out for yourself. So I really don't know what is going to happen with the fiscal year 11 budget, let alone the fiscal year 12 budget. But let me ask you this. I haven't heard space really even mentioned by the new Congress that is now in place in any of the budget discussions or anything. So my assumption is that space is not going to be on the minds of members of the House of Representatives, at least, and doesn't seem to be a high-priority item. Of course, the last couple of weeks, the deal in Egypt has moved pretty much everything off the front page, as well as the court action on Obamacare, so I understand that. But are you picking up any interest in the new conference, in the new Congress, in our space program, one way or the other?
No, like I say, I don't see strong leadership, and it's disappointing to me. And I have to think it's partly that the press has some culpability in that. You have someone like SpaceX doing something completely unprecedented and coming right after, literally on the heels of Obama setting this new direction for NASA, and we're going to use commercial services instead of owning and operating vehicles outright for a lot of stuff. And still the press is, there's an article in the New York Times about the launch in December and the perfect landing off the California coast. The New York Times article seemed more concerned with Elon's presumed arrogance, saying, sort of commenting on the demeanor of Elon Musk at the press conference, which I thought was sort of bizarre and really missed the point. The guy has a reason to be excited about what he's doing, and he's making history. And it's not getting that kind of attention in the press that I think it deserves. And when that doesn't happen, it's harder for other people to notice it. People who are right on top of it and really following it, like we are, really have an understanding of the relevance of all this. But I think for most people, and including people in Congress who aren't specialists in this area, they really have to have it spelled out for them.
Well, not just Congress, but also to the degree the general public matters. And I don't say that, listeners, to be callous, mean, or disrespectful, but to move to a policy, create something, you don't need to have 100% of everybody on board in support of that policy, but you do need to have key players, policymakers, staffers, members of Congress, and influential people across society to be able to do that. You know, they don't know Elon, so you're absolutely right, and they don't know the history of SpaceX, and they're probably clueless as to how really challenging and difficult and complex and expensive it is to do what SpaceX has been able to do with a fraction of the money spent by government programs over the years.
Yeah, and I think also the issue is partly confused by the fact that the launch was paid for by NASA. It was a sort of NASA, part of the COTS.
Part of the COTS program, yeah.
Program. So unless that gets teased out, what that means in a news article, NASA, this is a NASA project, but it's being done very differently from any other project. In other words, NASA didn't commission the building of this vehicle. They're only paying for that one launch, and putting in some seed money, and contributing some expertise. And NASA has created enormous opportunity for SpaceX to do this. That shouldn't be minimized, but it's very different from spending perhaps decades developing a vehicle. Dictating every piece of the design and being in charge of every part of the process from that design through building and launch and all that. It's very different. I think most people don't understand that. There needs to be a better job done explaining to people what this really means, and I think connecting the dots to the economy that, people are pretty upset, understandably, that there are a lot of jobs going to be lost when the shuttle gets taken offline. But the potential for many, many more jobs through a thriving space industry, space travel industry, is there. And some people get it. New Mexico is the spaceport there. And there's people, at various levels of things trying to get things happen. They do see that potential, but I think most people still don't get it, and they may not get it until actually comes to fruition.
Here's another email question for you, and again, listeners, go for the phone, 1-866-687-7223. This is Kristen in Eugene, Oregon, and Kristen says, I have in front of me an article from the other day on MSNBC that says NASA weighs plan to keep space shuttle until 2017, and it talks about a program that is being pushed to keep the shuttle flying with potentially two shuttle flights a year for about $1.5 billion a year. The article was written by Rob Coppinger. I'm wondering if you know anything about this effort. Do you think that it's a real effort, that there's any chance of it succeeding? I recall in reading the article, it said nothing about the cost involved in starting up discontinued manufacturing lines for parts and external tanks and things like that. It just talked about operating budgets of around $1.5 billion a year to keep two shuttles flying until 2017. Any thoughts on that? Are you knowledgeable about this? And as I said, do you think it could be real?
Well, as I understand it, that was a proposal under CCDEV-2 to provide commercial services to NASA. And they were proposing, I think it was the United Launch Alliance, proposing, which operates the shuttle now. Correct me if I'm getting any of this wrong, David.
No, you're right, but the article is from February 3rd, so it was a yesterday article.
Okay, and I think I've seen that article that she's talking about. My understanding was it was just a bid, to have United Launch Alliance do, a shuttle, continue to operate the shuttle sort of under a different rubric. as a as part of the commercial effort to serve a space station. My guess is it won't progress much beyond a study stage, and it's still not a long-term solution. These are aging vehicles that are very expensive to operate, and they also are inherently dangerous, and so not really geared toward routine operations.
I would bet that they don't try to resurrect those manufacturing lines and find employees and train people, and I just don't see it happening. I think the shuttle is retired.
I would like to see that. I would like to see that happen. You know, I remember when shuttle first launched. I was a kid, and I was very excited because I had missed out on all the Apollo stuff. And I thought, all right, this is it. You know, now there's something going on in space that I can see happening. I don't have to read about it in history books and stuff. And, I think the accident in 86 really changed my whole view of that whole thing. I became much more cynical about it. You know, that 25th anniversary just recently passed.
For Challenger, right?
Yeah, and I just like many people, I remember vividly that day and those horrible images, and I just felt, you know, I really, in a way, I mean, I felt terrible for the astronauts, but I also felt, in a way, let down, too, by what I thought was the program that had put us on the moon. It really made me start thinking that really wasn't the same program. And I really think the sooner the shuttle goes away, the better, and the sooner we can get truly routine operation in space, which I think can only come from commercial providers, the better.
I remember, the Apollo program, because it was, I was around for that and old enough to be really excited, but I remember the Apollo fire that we thought was going to sidetrack everything and how devastating, you know, that was. And up to that point, NASA had pretty much walked on water. I mean, they'd been amazing. And then to have that fire and the loss of the astronauts, and we were all very, very concerned that we would lose our program. So that's probably kind of comparable to what Challenger was for a lot of other people. And then Columbia, unfortunately.
Right, yeah. And it's interesting, after the fire, as I understand it, a lot of design corrections were made to make the vehicle.
Oh, yeah, totally redone, and they got rid of oxygen in the cabin like that and, put in different kinds of materials that were not so easy to catch on fire. It's unfortunate that these changes come after a tragedy and that the people aren't wise enough to see them, you know, beforehand.
But unfortunately, with the shuttle, I don't think it's possible to correct those changes without basically building correct those flaws without building a new vehicle. I mean, you've got these segmented solid fuel rocket boosters that are always going to have these points of failure along their line.
Well, yeah, but if you violate the protocols and launch outside the parameters of what they're designed for, remember the engineers were saying don't do it on Challenger. And then it appears that on Columbia, people ignored existing problems. And ultimately, you know, when you ignore things, it catches up to you and bites you pretty damn hard.
I think that, you know, it's an indication that so much of you know, I hate to generalize across the whole agency, because I know, you know, there's so many different parts and components, and there's so many different people who, with so many differing opinions, and I hope the right people will prevail there, who are fighting right now to get us on a real, get us back to a real space exploration program. But, it seems, unfortunately, that so much of what NASA is about has become just about being NASA and continuing its own existence, and the mission has kind of been lost. And what are we really trying to do? You know, it becomes more about, we got to keep all these people employed. We got to keep these contracts going to the right places. And, who knows what will happen with that? I mean, I'm optimistic. I do think that the space flight industry, you know, human space exploration and routine operations in orbit will go without NASA. So NASA can either get run over by the bus or get on board, and I think ultimately they'll have to get on board. There'll be no other real option.
No, I think you're right. We'll do one more listener question, and then we'll take our first break. And this is Alan, who is in Denver, Colorado. And Alan says earlier in the discussion you mentioned the administration space policy. Many of us, while we're not attached necessarily to Constellation, do believe that we should not have abandoned returning to the moon as a near-term priority and that we need to have destinations for our program. Can you comment on having given up destinations for something that appears to many of us to be much more vague? And also, what are your thoughts on our eventual returning to the moon?
I think if we return to the moon, we're going to have to do it in a sustainable way, and I think that means in some way that turns a profit for someone. I think that will entail things like the Google Lunar X Prize that's going on now. There's a prize now for $30 million for the first team that can land a rover near an Apollo landing site and return video. That kind of thing is exciting to me because that's a path to profitability. I mean, you can sell that. That's a commodity or something you can send back, high-definition video. Like David Gump, who's involved with that, one of the prize teams, had tried for years to get a similar operation going where he would sell, where his company would sell the video and also the right to control the rover, so you could actually pay some fee and actually control yourself with some kind of video game interface, the rover, and drive around yourself on the moon. I mean, that would be tremendous. And I think that kind of thing is what's going to get us back, really, to stay on the moon, not just to do a stunt where we go and land and, you know, hang out and say, yeah, we were still the greatest. You know, it's got to be more than that. I think that's yesterday's mission. I think we need to do something else now.
What if you're the guy driving the rover and you crash it up and wreck it or send it off into a crater?
Okay. Or run into Apollo 11, you know, something like that. Boy, that'd be just,
you know, or, you know, who knows what. But, boy, wouldn't that – I guess there'd have to be some safeguards to where, you couldn't crash it or drive it intoxicated or something like that.
But, yeah. Yeah, well, then there's also their space adventures. They still, you know, they're still floating that proposal to have someone spend $100,000 to do a flyby around the moon.
Well, I think it's gone up in price now.
What is it now?
I just saw that about 2 weeks ago, and when I was in North Dakota, I saw something about it, and I think it was in the neighborhood of 200 plus or something.
Yeah.
For the lunar flyby.
Okay.
But I don't have any details on it, and I just don't know. I shouldn't comment on it.
But that's a demonstrated market. You know, people have already spent what the last person spent on a Space Adventures brokered flight on the Soyuz. It was
well, they're approaching 30 million now.
Yeah, it's way up there.
And the Russians are really good at price increases in capitalism. So,
well, that's what I find so ironic. You know, we beat the Russians to the moon, ostensibly proving that capitalism is the best system, and now they're beating us at our own game. But I think it's really still only temporary. And most of these efforts are the commercial efforts, the most advanced and far along are here in the United States.
And in fact, when we come back, I want to ask you about something related to that. I'm not sure if you're up on the European Code of Conduct and what this may or may not mean for commercial space development. I'm seeing a lot of this coming through on the space advocacy side, the Space Frontier Foundation side. My more industry-oriented sides are supportive of it and talking about orderly rules of the road to support and facilitate everyone, including ways to mitigate against satellite collisions and stuff. I'll ask you if you're up on all of this and what your thoughts are when we come back from the break. And if you're not up on it, we'll go to something else. So everybody stay right where you are. We'll be back with Michael in about 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
The mission of the Space Show is to promote future economic opportunities, scientific discoveries, and medical advances for all humankind through peaceful and cooperative ventures in outer space. The Space Show intends to be the forum by which space exploration becomes an integral part of our culture, our economy, our country, our world, and our global vision, in which all nations unite in creating a thriving future through the enormous potentials afforded by off-Earth opportunities. The Space Show is committed to advancing integrity and responsibility, both in our off-Earth conduct and in the potential long-range consequences of our actions in space. The Space Show wants to make the dreams of space today the realities of tomorrow.
And welcome back, everybody. You're listening to The Space Show. Our guest today, Michael Belfiore. So, Michael, let me just do a little bit more of a background, and then we can discuss this issue. The Russians and the Chinese have wanted to put forth a new outer space treaty for quite some time, and both the Bush administration and the Obama administration have opposed a new space treaty on the order of what Russia and China have been talking about, which would sort of control satellites, launches, military use, national security use, you know, things like that. The Europeans, on the other hand, have come up with a European code of conduct for how we are to behave in space. So this code of conduct, which you can easily find all over the internet, is created by policymakers, and it comes, again, from the Europeans, and they don't have an emerging, developing, entrepreneurial, and commercial space industry. You know, most of all of their space is government and civil, and their companies are partially private, partially nationalized, like Ariane, which has never turned a profit and just got subsidies again. There are exceptions, like in the UK, you have Surrey Satellite, which is a private company. So yes, there are clearly exceptions, but there really isn't a thriving commercial, entrepreneurial, emerging space industry in Europe. So signing the European Code of Conduct is voluntary, and it has some really important stuff in it because it controls or tries to control traffic management to avoid satellite collisions, to restrict adding more debris to space, you know, having end of life programs on satellites that are launched, and I just did a program on Monday from the Ramon Space Conference in Israel about the high risk of GEO and GTO satellite collisions and what this would do to the GEO belts, and mostly we talk about collisions in LEO and Middle Earth orbit, but you ought to listen to this show with Maydad Pariente from Israel, and as I said, he delivered a paper on this, and a collision in GEO would be really damaging, and they've got ideas on how to track satellites so you know exactly where they are rather than approximately where you are, lots of information. So this is all covered in the Code of Conduct. But the other part of it is, because there's very little or no commercial industry, the players in the Code of Conduct are the Defense Department, National Security Space, policymakers, but the commercial industry has not been represented and is not represented. So the concern with the emerging commercial industry, especially from what I've read in the New Space blogs and New Space email groups, is that you have policy being made by people who have no experience, expertise, or knowledge about profit, capitalism, the bottom line, doing business. So what may end up are a whole series of regulations that add significantly to the cost of doing business, which could really skew returns on investment, business plans, operating costs, or in some instances, it could even restrict the access of commercial users in space. And our administration is wanting to sign on to it, but there are many Republicans in the Senate who say they have opposed it and have written a letter, but most of their opposition is around national security issues and defense programs already underway and at least partially funded that would probably be thwarted or maybe slowed down or even totally derailed by our signing on to the European Code. So I'm far from an expert on this, but that's kind of where the debate is on this. So, you know, what do you know about it? I mean, I think orderly rules, traffic management, satellite collision mitigation, you know, protecting satellites so that they don't just, you know, stay useless in dead orbits and things like that are all reasonable and would facilitate commerce.
Yeah, indeed. In fact, it might be essential for it. And it strikes me as similar to the beginning of the jet age back in the early mid-50s when it became possible for passenger transports to, you know, cross continents and oceans much more quickly than before. The need was seen to create what you're talking about, some kind of rules, you know, that would allow commercial operators to know what they're dealing with, you know, so, you know, they wouldn't just pass from one jurisdiction into another and have completely different rules. You know, to have some kind of uniform structure within which everyone knows how to operate, I think that's going to be really important. Whether it's this agreement or not, I mean, I've been looking at it as we talked and during the break, and it, you know, the intention seems good. You know, we've got to have some way to make sure people aren't just going to be wantonly blowing up satellites and creating lots of debris for other operators. You know, there's things in there about you want to try to keep space as a peaceful place and not as a place of conflict. Well, that's probably not going to hold much. I mean, wherever people have gone, whether it's land or sea or air, they've always brought conflict with them. I think that's inevitable in space. And, on some level, that's going to happen. But I think the intentions are good to create some beginning, to create some kind of beginning of a framework that everyone can operate within and know what the rules are. And of course, you know, there's always a danger of over-regulation and having regulations that are going to restrict commercial operations. But I think as long as the commercial operators are part of the discussion, and maybe that's the problem right now, that they're not enough a part of that discussion.
Well, my understanding is they were not part of it on the European side. And the code of conduct is being presented, and you can either sign it or not. It's voluntary.
Yeah.
But my understanding, and again, I'm far from an expert on this, it's not being negotiated to change the terms of it.
Right.
I don't know if that's fact or not. That's just kind of my lacking of expertise, understanding of it. Possibly it is still up for further negotiation, and commercial interests can be part of that process. I simply don't know.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to be at the FAA conference next week in Washington, and Robert Bigelow is going to be there, and Mike Gold and people from SpaceX, along with FAA officials.
Well, it's going to be brought up because when this hit the Space Frontier Foundation email group, which is where I'm getting a lot of the information from, they were talking about taking it directly to Comstock next week.
Yeah, so that'll be interesting. I mean, this is the first of that iteration of that conference since the new policy and SpaceX's achievements. You know, they did two test flights last year, one with a mock-up and one with a prototype capsule. And so I think it's going to be a very interesting conference.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you. Do you think that if you were a betting guy, SpaceX has a couple of more launches set for this spring, I think. Do you think they're going to sail through without a difficulty, without a launch disaster, without a failure? I mean, that's almost unheard of.
Yeah, it's almost a little spooky.
I know I probably shouldn't have brought it up and
of course,
and
I
hexed
don't want
it.
To see them fail in any respect. I'm really rooting for them. But they're really, they've really pulled off something pretty astounding. I mean, to get two orbit of a brand new vehicle without a serious mishap is pretty amazing, and who knows whether they can keep it up. I mean, they really are pioneers, though, and they're doing things that other people haven't done in terms of their operations and design and production. Everything is different, and it's hard to compare it with previous government efforts. So, you know, optimistically, maybe we can say that they are demonstrating a better, more effective way of doing space. At the same time, the laws of physics are the same, or, you know, they haven't changed, and there's always a potential for an accident. And it's inevitable that eventually, maybe not this year or even next year, but somewhere down the road, there's going to be accidents, and people will die in space. And we, if we're going to take the risks that we need to do this, and I think... it's absolutely the right thing to do. We're going to have to take our lumps, too, and that's just the way it goes.
Listeners, our toll-free number is 1-866-687-7223. Larry in Little Rock, Arkansas, says there is much discussion about man rating, or I should say human rating, to be politically correct, the EELV rockets, rather than doing anything with, say, Constellation. What are your thoughts on converting the EELV to human rating and using them to take astronauts to the station?
I think it could absolutely be done. I don't know what man rating means. I mean, do you, David? Are there guidelines?
I had George Sowers of ULA on, and he mostly talked about Atlas because Atlas has a longer successful track record and lineage in history than Delta, but not by much because Delta... four heavy is also outstanding too, but he said most of the work that they're doing to human rate an EELV has to do with systems that can detect that there is a problem with the rocket and either shut the thing down immediately. I mean, we're talking about fractions of seconds, or an abort system that throws the capsule containing the astronauts way away from the damn thing because it's probably going to explode, and then bring the capsule back down to Earth safely. So it's sensors all over the rocket and systems that can clamp down in, you know, fractions of seconds to either stop a problem or, you know, force the abort of the astronauts and eject them and get them away. He said that most of the rocket systems themselves are redundant and very, very reliable. I think he said Atlas has had something like 94 consecutive successful launches. I may have that. My memory may be off on that. It may have been a string of successful launches since 1994 instead of 94 actual launches. So anyway, it's on the show for people who want to go back and listen to it. And... Delta's a little bit newer, so its string of successful launches is marginally less than Atlas. But that's basically what they do. They say this, the rocket systems themselves are extremely reliable and proven and redundant. So it's the sensors, detection systems, abort systems, ejection, you know, the stuff that will save the astronaut's life. And then he was asked if they have to change the flight profile to minimize G-force, because shipping and sending a satellite up can take a whole lot of G-force in the trajectory, whereas humans can't do that. So he said that's easy to do. We modify trajectory and G-force all the time depending on where we're sending the payload. There's really not much to that. So that... is an issue that they're all aware of, but doesn't receive a whole lot of attention as being something special that they have to accomplish.
Now, did he say what it would take to get? Because I agree. I think the technology is there and the vehicles are there. It could be used, but what doesn't seem to be there is the will to use them, at least right now.
Well, he thought that they would be used, and you know, he was asked a lot of questions about the timeline and the cost of doing this, and he was kind of vague on all of that. But he did come out and he said he tells his payload people or whatever these things are going to launch that he, meaning ULA, which has both Atlas and Delta, are going to be ready to launch human payloads far in advance of when the human payload people are going to be ready to match their payloads to an EELV.
Now, is he talking about Orion or the Bigelow Boeing vehicle?
He was talking about being able to accommodate and take anything that any company could make.
That anyone could make.
Yeah, so they're not wedded specifically to Bigelow. He indicated they could put a Dragon capsule on it. Even Orion, and when I interviewed Larry Price, who is head of the Orion project for Lockheed Martin, I've interviewed him 2 years in a row at the AIAA meetings in California, and he was asked about this, and he said he didn't know, he was sure that they could put Orion on an Atlas or a Delta, but the mission would probably be modified because Orion was made to go on Constellation. And if you end up changing such an important component of how the mission was synergistically designed in the first place, you're going to have changes in the mission and the performance and all of that. But he said they could probably do test flights on a Delta before an Atlas, only because timing-wise, the Delta could probably be made ready sooner than an Atlas. I didn't really pick that up from George, but that's probably for most of us, you know, we don't really care which one it goes on, right? He wasn't quite as confident that Orion could go on a Falcon 9, only because he didn't have enough information about what the Falcon 9 could do, could take, could carry, the dimensions, you know, all of that kind of stuff. But he said, yeah, we could put Orion on basically anything and make it work. So
now that's if somebody tells them to do it, if some leader.
Well, yeah, somebody, there has to be a market for it,
right,
or a decree to go do it.
Right, and that's why I think that SpaceX is going to get there first, because we've got Elon Musk saying we're going to do it no matter what. It's just inherently a good thing to do, and I'm going to stake my fortune on this. And everything he does is geared toward that goal of getting people into space. I mean, everything from satellite launches to his interactions with NASA, everything is really focused on a very clear mission.
I don't think he will wait for a government program. I mean, the problem with Lockheed and all of these companies is they're so used to doing a project that is a government program. They certainly don't do a project on spec, let's call it what it is, on spec, like building spec homes. I mean, Elon Musk seems to be far more willing to do a space project on spec, right?
Right. Yeah, he's got this amazing combination of the will, you know, the commitment to do it, and the resources and the financial backing. He's got all of that in one place. And
yeah.
I don't see any other orbital launch vehicle that has all of those.
Well, the Boeing one that they're talking about making, which hasn't yet you know, progress beyond theory, concept, PowerPoint, view graph, you know, their commercial one. You know, that's out there, and if Boeing decides to actually bend the metal on it.
Which one? I missed what you said.
Well, Boeing has a capsule that they want to make for the commercial market. So that would probably be closer to what SpaceX is doing.
I think you're right. I think that is the closest. And I think the wild card there is Bigelow. I mean, he could provide the impulse, the motive force to get it going, potentially. I don't see Boeing doing it on its own without government, you know, making them, you know, having the government as a clear customer. Yes, we are going to, you know, give you money to do this. But, you know, I know Bigelow's not known for his patience. So, and he really wants to have a vehicle ready to service his stations when they're up there, and I guess he's saying 2014 now.
You weren't at AIAA in Anaheim, were you, in August, September of last year?
No.
He talked for about 45 minutes at the special commercial space meeting that we had, I think, Tuesday night. There were maybe close to 60, 70 people in the room, and Bob was pretty much the keynote speaker. And, you know, obviously he was asked a lot about timelines and all of this, and, you know, he said he's ready to go. He's really hoping that he can make this by around 2015 at the latest. But his significant weak link is that he needs a launch ride.
Yeah, that's always been.
And that is the weakest link and can actually take him down.
Yeah, sure.
So he is very much aware of this. He is in discussions with ULA. I'm sure he's in discussions with Elon, too. I don't know that he's in any discussions with foreign launchers. I know he had really nasty experiences going through ITAR in launching Genesis 1 and 2 on the Dnieper rocket with Russia. Whether he is looking at a foreign launcher or he's trying to stay with whatever the Americans can throw together and make work, I can't tell you that. But his weak link and what can choke him to death is the absence of a launcher.
Right, absolutely. But yeah, it's always been, you know, when I first started following him, you know, right pretty early on in his program, he said that he got into the destination business because he assumed that by the time he got there would be a vehicle. And as things have unfolded and he's progressing and there still isn't a vehicle, he's getting kind of nervous. And he's also very upfront about his motivations. He's not a young man, and he wants to do this. It's his life's mission. It's his life's work to do this. And so he's going to do whatever it takes within his means to get it to happen.
I mean, he may not be a young man. I guess he's, you know, in and around my age, give or take. He is in outstanding condition and shape.
Oh, yeah, and incredible.
He is like the silver-haired fox, you know what I mean? I mean, he's an amazing guy.
Stark, the Iron Man character.
Yeah, he is an amazing guy, and he's approachable, and, you know, I really think that the commercials, the developing and emerging space industry, more or less is going to follow the success of SpaceX and Bigelow more than any of the other companies.
I totally agree with you. And in some ways, it's really exciting. You know, there are certain people who pop up at just the right time in history to get things done. You know, we had Henry Ford, and, you know, I think that's an apt comparison, people like that. We have people like this right now doing this, and you never really think about decades later, well, what if Ford hadn't come along and started mass-producing automobiles? You know, he didn't invent the automobile, but he made it commercially viable on a large scale. And if he hadn't come along, would somebody else have done it? Well, probably in that industry, because it's not nearly as expensive to build an automobile as a space vehicle. But here we've got a situation where, well, if it wasn't for these guys, who would do this? Would there be somebody to step up? I mean, would someone like Richard Branson do it? I don't know. I'm kind of holding my breath. I really want these guys to succeed and get this thing going so that it can keep going beyond them.
You know, absolutely. So there's a lot of potential excitement out there, and I guess there's a lot of potential setbacks too if things head south for whatever reason. So,
there's always the chance of an accident. I mean, I still don't know. Does anyone in the public know what happened with Spaceship Two's rocket motor development? I mean, they had an explosion. I think it was in 07.
I asked Mark about that at that commercial space AIAA meeting where Bob Bigelow was talking. And I talked to him about it, and I actually would like to get Mark on that. This is Mark Sarangelo, everybody,
yeah,
who's head of the space division for Sierra Nevada, and they are doing the engine. you know, the rumors are out there that Spaceship Two has a real problem with their engine. So I asked him. I mean, we were sitting in, we were standing in the back of the room, you know, snacking away and drinking, and lightly drinking. And I'm not even sure Mark had a drink in his hand, and I had a Diet Coke, just to be clear, everybody. And I asked him about the rumors, and you know, he vehemently denied them. And he did say that, there's not a whole lot he can talk about publicly because they have NDAs and things like that, and sure. And that's all clearly reasonable, and I would expect that. But he, as strongly as he could, looked me right in the eye and refuted all of those rumors and said that their engine development program is going on track.
What concerned me is that after the accident, Bert Rutan said that he was going to make public the details of what went wrong and how it was corrected once they figured those things out, and so that no one else would have to repeat that those problems.
Uh-huh.
And I haven't seen that yet. I haven't seen anyone come out and say, hey, this is what happened, this is how we corrected it. And I think they have every incentive to do that because they've got passengers, you know, high-value passengers lining up. It would definitely help their business to come out with a very clear statement explaining just what went wrong and just how it was corrected. So that's what concerns me, that they haven't done that yet.
Well, you know, I take a more rational approach to it, because if they're at some point, you're not going to be able to hide behind rhetoric and phony baloney press releases and other stuff that businesses and companies put out. At some point, you have to face reality and take your hits. So to the degree that they're covering up something, and I mean, they're not going to be able to do it indefinitely. At some point, they're going to have to perform or not perform, and they're going to have to make it public that they have or don't have an engine.
Yeah.
And so, you know, to think that they're stupid enough that they think they can hide this on an indefinite basis, there's nothing about these people, and I know so many of them personally, as do you, that suggest to me that A, they're without integrity, and B, that they're that stupid.
Right. No, I totally agree with you, and I think that I'm optimistic that they will correct the problem, but what I'm saying is that I'm not sure they've done it yet to their satisfaction, to where they're ready to.
Unknown. I don't know, Mark. I mean, he did say that these rumors are unfounded. He had heard them too. And I said, if you'll come on to the space show, can I ask you this question? Will you talk about it on air? And he said, yeah, I'll do exactly what I'm doing with you right now.
Yeah.
So
it's important too, and I think everyone realizes too, to realize that this is a risky endeavor. I mean, there's no way around it. It's going to be as safe as it's humanly possible to make it at this point in our technological development. But there are still risks involved, and everyone who flies on that vehicle or any new space vehicle is a pioneer. Every bit as much as any of the engineers or pilots or investors, and my hat's off to them, because we need those people to open the frontier.
And my take in talking to all these people is that they're fully aware of all of this, that they're competent, that they are not incompetent, and above all, they're extremely conscientious, and they absolutely have an awareness and know throughout, you know, their entire genetic makeup, the consequences of an accident, not just for the people who are in the accident, but for the company as well as for the industry at large. To me, these people are extremely conscientious and doing everything they can to be quality-driven, safety-driven, and performance-driven in how they're going through with their programs. And I've found this on every single one of these companies and these people that I talk to, even companies that are not in the specific market of, say, what Virgin is. This is an amazing, sensitive, conscientious, and from my perspective, highly ethical business and a group of people that perform in that way.
Yeah, I agree with you. I mean, everyone I've spoke with at Scale Composites and at Virgin has struck me the same way. I mean, these are these are incredible people who are really going to set the tone for everyone who follows them. And pressure's on for those folks. But if anyone can pull it off, it's going to be them. You know, this reminds me of, you know, I mentioned before the beginning of the era of jet travel, and again, this reminds me of that. And it, partly it's because I just finished reading a really good book by Sam Verhovec, the former New York Times reporter. It's called Jet Age. In fact, I reviewed it for the New York Times. It's going to be out this Sunday.
Uh-huh.
But it's about the beginning of the age of jet travel, and there's a lot of parallels. They're very interesting. You had, you know, just a couple of companies. It was de Havilland and Boeing out in front. And, of course, de Havilland had the first jet aircraft, passenger aircraft in service. It was the Comet. It was ill-fated, and it had a serious design flaw that doomed several ships. You know, they called them ships back then, in flight, and that allowed Boeing to grab the second mover advantage. It's very interesting to see the personalities and engineering that was going on then. This author writes about the passengers, and it's very clear just how pioneering those efforts were that led to the age we live in now, where we just take it for granted that, you know, the biggest pain in the ass we're going to have when we fly is we're going to have to wait in a security line. You know, we forget what an achievement that was, and the fact that people actually gave their lives to make that possible, to make jet travel just completely routine and even boring and mundane. And we're at the beginnings of that now with space travel. I think in 50 years, you know, we'll be in a similar spot in space as we are now with jet travel.
Did you talk to the author of that book? Do you know him?
No, I haven't talked to him, and I don't know. In fact, the Times was anxious to learn whether I did have any contact with them, sort of implying that I might not be given the book to review if I did. They wanted it to be unbiased by any.
I'd like to get him on the space show. That's why I was asking if you had his contact information or knew how to reach him.
I could easily get it. Yeah, why don't I give that to you offline?
Yeah, if you would. I think that'd be a really interesting and dynamic space show with a lot of parallels. Let me go back to questions for you. Sandra in Tucson, Arizona, and I guess because we're coming up on the bewitching hour of the show, we'll skip that break if that's okay with you.
Sure.
But Sandra in Tucson says, given that you have an expertise in NASA, I continue to hear many people putting forth the argument that NASA should be restructured, as a DARPA-like organization instead of the way NASA is functioning now. Do you have any thoughts on that, and is it at all possible or feasible?
It's very interesting, the history of NASA and DARPA, because DARPA came along first just by a few months as America's first space agency. That's mostly what, in fact, it was pretty much all they were focused on, and they were touted as the new space agency. The Eisenhower administration created DARPA, and it was called ARPA, as the response to Sputnik, with the understanding that another agency would come along, a much larger and, you know, perhaps unsaid at the time, bureaucratic organization that would be a real heavy lifter, literally, and that became NASA. But DARPA created some of the programs that NASA then took over, like the effort to build the moon rocket headed by Wernher von Braun. That started as a DARPA program, and NASA took it over and, you know, they sort of absorbed it. And so NASA was really based on this one mission, whereas DARPA managed to sort of wiggle out from under that space program designation and branch out into all different areas, which was its salvation and led to its huge success later, creating the Internet and all kinds of things. But NASA started out as this, you know, just balls-to-the-wall effort to do whatever it took to capture the high ground in space, and all sorts of decisions came from that, like to have NASA centers that were owned and operated by NASA, whereas DARPA has always just maintained its own office building and contracted out all of the functions to build new technology. So DARPA can easily let go of a particular line of endeavor if it doesn't pan out, can easily just move on to something else. There isn't a huge overhead it has to maintain, whereas NASA is just the opposite. It's got these these centers all over the country that have to be fed and are focused on very specific things. And so it's very, very hard for NASA to change direction and decide, you know, for instance, we're not going to be in the business of, you know, sending space probes out. Like, you know, let's just not fund JPL next year. Well, they can't do that because JPL is actually a part of NASA. You know, not that I think they should do that, by the way. But so, you know, I think NASA needs to move in that direction, and I think they are with these commercial projects. We talk about SpaceX. They're also buying services of suborbital vehicles. They're buying data from the potential winners of the Google Lunar X Prize. That's the kinds of things that DARPA is into, and I think that's the right direction. I don't know whether NASA, as we know it, could shift whole scale to that kind of operation. And, you know, I think that it started out, you know, it sort of grew out of an aeronautical research organization that became NASA. Whether it can ever go back to that previous purely research mode is doubtful. I don't know, but we're in interesting times. So it's very hard to predict.
Well, if Congress mandated that NASA revert back to its, what was it called, NRC or what
NACA.
Was it? And say it again.
NACA?
NACA, yeah, the NACA format. And Congress mandated that over the next, pick a number, 8 years. Do you think NASA could actually evolve into doing that?
I think it would take leadership not just from Congress and the presidential administration, but within NASA, too. And I've talked to people at NASA who are, you know, sort of in the trenches, engaged in a struggle of trying to convince their colleagues that, you know, NASA has to change and evolve to meet the new times. And it's a real struggle. I mean, there are people there who are just digging in their heels, and they do not want to change the way things are done, and they're going to fight it every step of the way and with everything at their disposal. So, you know, I get the feeling there's this group of radicals there who are trying to move NASA into the future, who have a real struggle on their hands, and it's not at all clear yet where it's going to go. And one person who spoke to me off the record suggested that it might be problematic at the top of the organization, that the NASA administrator at the very top it may not be fully committed to this new direction and may not be doing what it will take to fully implement the president's new policy.
Have you talked to Administrator Bolden?
I haven't spoken with him directly, no.
So you've not done an interview or anything with him?
No. Have you?
No. They here is what I have found. It's you can take a top person like Bolden and others and put them at a conference, a friendly conference, a space conference, and they can deliver pretty much a prepared talk, and they may even be willing to take one or two or three questions. And what they say and how they respond to the questions can be pretty controlled. Just because of you're within the walls of a conference and you've given a prepared talk and you want to stick on that topic, and if you're at all adept at staying focused rather than, you know, being sidetracked into making a hellaciously wrong, stupid comment like our vice president does sometimes, you know, you're okay. Put these guys on a 90-minute radio talk show where they're going to get calls and emails from listeners on everything from the most wildly fantasy-driven Looney Tunes topic to something they would really wish they never had to address.
Right.
They don't do well.
Yeah.
And their handlers, and they all have handlers, are really concerned about what they're going to say, so they don't come on the show.
Yeah.
I without naming any names, there are a lot of programs I do where the condition of having the guest is that someone from their organization, company, museum, whatever, pick any adjective you want, is on another line monitoring what is said.
Interesting.
And they do intra special IMs back and forth that I'm not privy to.
Wow.
And this helps the guest make sure that they don't run afoul and say the wrong thing, divulge something, make an ITAR mistake, whatever, let your imagination run wild.
Yeah.
And if I want to do these shows, the guests are, let's use the term, moderated.
Yeah.
And I'm really used to it. It is totally seamless. Listeners don't know it's going on. I haven't really ever felt or experienced being misled or being diverted, but I have seen a lot of clarification statements. And so where that may come in is they'll make a comment about, here, I'll pick something at random, Charlie Bolden going to China. And our Chinese policy or whatever. And so they'll speak about that, and their comments are okay. There's nothing really, from what I can tell, controversial. We'll take a break. We'll come back after the break, and they'll say something like, I want to go back to talking about Administrator Bolden in China because I want to make sure everybody clearly understands where I'm coming from, and da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's done very seamlessly. You know, you don't have any sense that something is awry or anything. And the truth is, people often go back and correct what they say, or they say they want to clarify. I mean, I'm having this problem with my North Dakota class. I'm making comments in class, and then I'm getting email questions from the students who are misunderstanding or putting words in my mouth or saying things that I didn't do a good job of explaining. So I find that maybe a half a dozen times already in the semester, I have gone back in email format or chat format or when I was on campus in the spoken format saying, I want to make sure you understand what I was talking about yesterday.
Yeah.
So it's all really natural, but I happen to know what's going on because I know how the game is played.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, you know, I think partly it's an indication of an organization's size. I mean, a lot of people like to fault the government. Well, it's somehow inherent.
The bigger, the more likely it's going to happen.
Yeah. So, you know, I think large organizations tend to trend this way, and that's partly why folks like Bigelow and Elon Musk are managing to make these tremendous strides. It's because the buck stops with them. There's a clear person at the top who's got a clear mission. He's not afraid to state it and communicate it clearly to the rest of the organization. And I think it's much harder to do that when you've got larger organization with lots of different inputs.
But the times I've spoken with Bigelow, I mean, I spoke directly with Bob, and you know, he can readily handle himself. I've done countless shows with Elon as well as with Gwen, and you know, they're able to speak for themselves and not make stupid faux pas statements or something. But you get to these large bureaucratic government agencies or corporations, and there is a concern what people will say. And the truth is, I have found a lot of people don't want to face an open microphone for 90 minutes with questions coming from all over the place. Even if I asked them to deliver the talk I heard them give at the conference, they don't want to do it because it's an uncontrolled and an unfamiliar format for them. If I ask them to come on for 5 minutes or 10 minutes and do a soundbite, not a problem. As soon as you tell them 90 minutes with questions and comments coming from listeners all over the world, it's a different ballgame.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, I think partly it's a function, too, of somebody in position to toe a party line. So in other words, they're advancing an agenda that may not be exactly 100% in line with their own personal convictions and agenda. And that's partly the difference, I think, with someone like Bigelow or Musk. that they are absolute. Their company's mission is absolutely in line with
they are their company's
their
mission.
Personal convictions. Yeah. And I think that kind of the kind of power and strength that comes from that is really hard to duplicate any other way.
But you know, I could imagine doing a show with Charlie Bolden, which I would love to do, and he could possibly be attacked without mercy by listeners, and I don't screen the calls. Yeah. So I can keep a call from going over the airway, but I can't keep a call from being heard by the guest as well as myself.
Right.
So I can just imagine that there would be listeners, even if they're being civil and polite and doing it, would just want to crucify some of the government people or the big industry people. I mean, I've done a lot of shows with ATK, and I really enjoy interviewing people from ATK. I like the company. I think they're a great asset to America. I like what they're doing. I really am impressed with them. And they're all tape recorded because I go out to ATK when I'm at SmallSat, and I'm not doing a live show. And the amount of hate mail that comes in from the space advocacy, space cadet world, calling the people from ATK everything from liars to traitors to you name it, I can only imagine what they would do on a live show with these people. I mean, I've never seen such vehemence expressed against people who have really done great things for America, both in terms when they were in the military, when they flew for NASA, because a lot of these guys are shuttle pilots or high-ranking Air Force or Army officers. So I can imagine they don't really want to sit there and come into a totally open mic situation for 90 minutes, because they're going to get they feel they may get really hit. And even if I promise to control it, I'm not 100% effective.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely wouldn't want that job. To not be able to speak your mind, and then if you do, to have somebody check you, you know, at every turn. And I think, and that's partly why I think we really need to look to some of these smaller private companies for leadership here. And I think the others will follow. But you know, we may be asking too much of the government or from these bigger companies. So we may be asking for a type of leadership from them we're just not going to get.
I totally agree with you there. Look, we're approaching the top of the hour, which is a 90-minute show, but let me ask you to do some crystal ball gazing in our remaining time. What do you see for a fiscal year 11 budget when our illustrious members of Congress get around to doing what they're supposed to be doing? Are they going to cut NASA? How much are they going to cut it? And where do you think all of this ends up for fiscal year 12, and what do you think we'll have for a civil space program?
I think there's going to be some money for commercial development. And, you know, whether it's as much as people would like, that's another question. You know, it doesn't seem to follow any kind of rational process. I mean it is rational, but it's not based on the ostensible mission, which is to get people into space on a regular basis and explore beyond low Earth orbit.
I don't think the government cares about that.
Yeah, I mean, they're really concerned, I think, with keeping the jobs going to the right places, keeping the right contracts in place, and however that gets done, that's what you know, is going to... So I think we're going to have some kind of... we may have some kind of zombie space program that's shambling along and sucking in a lot of money to, you know, something like Orion or Constellation. Maybe it'll come under a different name. Maybe it'll be the heavy lift thing. But I think there will be enough. Enough for some people, but I think there'll be enough of a trickle of money coming in to help things like SpaceX and Armadillo Aerospace and Maston Space doing suborbital stuff and other ventures, just to keep them going. These are committed, passionate people who are going to do whatever it takes to keep going. I mean, you know, I was hanging out with Maston Space when they just moved out to Mojave, you know, and those guys were, you know, working out of this terrible old 1940s aircraft hangar, and they were scrimping and saving, and they, you know, they didn't have places to live, and man, they've been pulling themselves along, you know, bit by bit, and they're finally at the point where they're really doing some pretty amazing stuff, and they've managed to attract contracts, and a little bit goes a long way for an operation like that. You know, they've got
and they won the Lunar Lander Prize. So
yeah, I mean, it's just a tremendous achievement, and I think, you know, for especially a group like that, people who don't have the financial backing of a Bigelow or a SpaceX, that, you know, who really just very passionate people and very talented engineers who have a vision, and it's amazing what folks like this can do with even just the smallest amount of financial wherewithal. So as long as there's some of that still going to the right places, I think we'll get there. And who knows, you know, what'll happen in 2011 with the NASA budget, though. It's just
well, you think they're going to go like cuts across the board, 10% here, 15% there, or do you think NASA will get through unscathed?
I don't think I think it's still they're in the meat grinder. I think, you know, what comes out on the other side, who knows? If there's one thing I really wish, I really wish Obama would get behind that policy speech he made last April, where he said, we're going to do a new thing with NASA, we're going to do this commercial thing, it's going to create new jobs, blah, blah, blah. He had the right rhetoric. And I'd love to see him just get behind that. Go down to NASA HQ and knock some heads together, go to Congress, you know, and kick some butt there. I don't see his commitment to doing that either. And so who knows what's going to happen.
No, space is hard to get the national priority commitment, isn't it?
There's a lot else going on. I mean, to be charitable, I mean, there's so many other things that folks consider more important than that. You know, I think we know, and the probably most of the listeners know, that space should be a very high priority, but most folks aren't going to get that until we actually build a thriving space industry, infrastructure in orbit with folks traveling on a regular basis there and beyond.
What can we expect from Michael Belfiore in 2011?
Well, I'm going to keep going to conferences and keep finding innovative companies that I get excited about, and I'm blogging more regularly on my website. I'm really have started to think more of my site as my first priority for media. You know, in the past, I've gone to my magazine editors and newspaper editors and pitched stories to them, and it can be a lengthy process, and you know, my blog has taken second place to that. Now I've really decided to focus first and foremost on that blog and go out, put videos up there, get my first juiciest information out there first, and see what happens from there. I think this stuff is too important to let fall by the wayside just because I can't sell a magazine story on it. So to finance this, I'm taking on more speaking gigs. I'm going to corporations and other places that have a real interest in seeing how truly innovative companies and individuals are doing extraordinary things, and maybe can be inspired to do things in their own organization as well.
What is your blog address again?
It's michaelbelfiore.com, and then you can also find it by just Googling author and speaker on innovation. It should be the first hit when you do that.
Innovation.com?
It's author and speaker on innovation.
Okay.
If you do a Google search, you should get my website first. My website is michaelbelfiore.com.
Right.
It's B-E-L-F-I-O-R-E.
And listeners, he has a free newsletter you can subscribe to.
Right, you sign up there. I've got a Twitter feed going. It's an amazing time, and I'm just really excited to be here at this moment in time in a front row seat to see some changes that are happening that are going to really influence the way we all live in the next few years and decades.
Any pearls of wisdom for us? What would be our takeaway from our discussion this morning?
I think it's easy when you look at the details, you know, like the messy business of getting from point A to point B and changing minds and trying to develop new technologies, do things differently. It's easy to get discouraged and to see that it's a messy process. People don't agree. People don't put money in the right things. People don't invest in the right ways. But I really do think, though, that we are living in one of the most extraordinary times that is on a par with perhaps the beginning of the 60s, you know, when we saw the first ramp up to manned spaceflight and all kinds of other innovations were going on, information technology, the internet was coming on. All these things were happening. I think we're in a very similar time right now. There's a lot of exciting things happening in a lot of different fields, information technology. I mean, just for example, autonomous vehicles are probably going to be a regular part of our lives within the next 5 to 10 years, where you can get in your car and just tell it where you want to go. It'll drive itself. Tens of thousands of lives could be saved just with that technology. And drunk driving won't be an issue. Texting while driving, every car can see itself, see other traffic on the road, and know what it's doing and communicate its status through networking. That's just one example. And of course, amazing things happening in space. There's just so much going on. This energy revolution that we were talking about at the beginning of the show, the distributed power generation, I think, is in our future, where every house or business can generate most of its own energy needs just in place. That'll have big implications about national security and all kinds of different things. So everything we do depends on energy. So if you get that one in place, we're going to see big advances in every other area, too.
People who may want to send you an email or get a hold of you, do you give out your address, or do you want me to filter for you?
Oh, sure. Just don't post it on the site for spam bots to find it. But anyone is welcome to email me. I welcome comments and feedback at michael@michaelbelfiore.com.
Okay. What conferences are you headed to next?
So next week I'm going to the FAA AST conference, Commercial Space Flight Conference. A lot of the people we've been talking about are going to be there and get updates on what they're doing. Robert Bigelow is giving the keynote talk there. So I'm excited about that. I'm excited about meeting some of these mavericks at NASA who are going to be there, who I've spoken with on the phone but haven't met in person. People fighting the good fight to help further the commercial space industry from within NASA. And after that, I'm heading to the second annual ARPA-E conference. It's the agency, it's part of the Department of Energy that was inspired by DARPA. It was created under Bush and funded under Obama. It's called ARPA-E. So they're trying to do what DARPA does, but just focus on energy. So it's going to be a big convention of entrepreneurs and innovators showing their work, and they're going to be program managers there and all kinds of...
Where is that conference?
That's going to be in Washington as well. And anyone who's interested in that, you can just search ARPA-E online. It's ARPA-E. And that's very exciting endeavor. I don't think it's getting quite enough funding, but they're working with about $500 million, and they're letting out millions of dollars at a time to universities and private companies and entrepreneurs to try to make the breakthroughs in energy that we need to get off of our utter dependence on petroleum, things like battery technology, very efficient solar panels, wind power, just all kinds of things that people are working on right now.
Lots of things are going to be developing for sure over the next decade.
I think so. I think that the next 10 years is going to look very different from where we are now, and I think it's going to be better for us. Just imagine producing most of our own energy right here in this country rather than having to import so much of it. What it would do for the economy.
Well, what it would be, I guess I better sell my oil stocks before then.
I think you can hang on to them for a while.
I'm waiting for them to triple when they close the Suez Canal, so that's when I'll sell them and probably buy gold again. But Michael, this has been great. Aside from ComStack coming up, what's your space conference schedule? I'm trying to see if we're going to cross bridges here anyplace.
Yeah, what are you heading to next?
I'm going back to North Dakota to teach in April, so that pretty well kills my going to Space Access and a few other things, the Responsive Space Conference. I'll probably be at SmallSat again. That is in July. I'm sorry, August in Logan, Utah. Space Frontier Foundation New Space is in NASA Ames again. I'll probably be there in July.
Okay.
Not sure about the Mars Conference yet, Mars Society Conference. I'd like to return to it. I have to find out the days and times. Probably AIAA and AIAA took over the ISIS thing from the Automotive Engineering Group, SAE, and it's in Portland, and I forget when it is, but that would probably be an interesting conference to go to, too.
Mm-hmm. If you had to pick one conference, well, it's maybe not a fair question, but if you could only go to one in the next few months, which one would you pick?
I think the one that is probably the most valuable for me is the AIAA Space 2011, but that is not until September.
Yeah.
SmallSat is really valuable for me because I get a lot of programming there, and they have a great segment and display booths with a lot of incredible entrepreneurs doing really cool things with CubeSats and SmallSats. And even in the academic launch arena. So it's very fertile grounds for me. New Space is an hour's drive, so I'm always down there. And not only do I like the topics, I get to see a lot of friends.
Yeah.
So what about you? Will you be out at New Space?
Well, I don't know. That's why I'm asking, quizzing you about it, too. I got to make some choices.
I mean, you know, I don't have any expense account for travel, so it's...
Yeah. The way I'm going now, too, I don't either. At least, yeah, I'm finding, you know, the recession really hit the publishing industry pretty hard. And so editors used to send me to places like...
Well, not anymore, yeah.
But now they don't. So it's up to me to finance myself. It's partly why I'm doing more speaking, which I really enjoy, too. So that's fortunate.
So, I don't usually travel across the country to a D.C. conference because of exactly what you're talking about. So I look for things that are in my neighborhood and in my vicinity.
Mm-hmm.
So I think for New Space, if you want to be around most of the entrepreneurs and the people that are really pushing and leading it, there's two conferences for that. There is the New Space Conference and then Space Access in Phoenix in April. And I would have gone to Space Access, except I'll be in Grand Forks. And trust me, I much prefer Phoenix over Grand Forks.
Well, April's not such a bad time.
But I do like the campus a lot, and I love the people and the students and the department. So, you know, there's a lot of benefits for it.
Yeah.
But those are the two New Space environments that are, I think, really key. Mm-hmm. AIAA is much more traditional, big industry, although there's a lot of commercial space and New Space people there, and they have this New Space, this commercial space programming there. With people, and as I said, Bigelow was the keynote speaker, and Mark was there, and quite a few others. So it's a powerhouse pack of people, very, very fertile grounds, and a lot of the programming, the keynotes are outstanding.
Yeah.
Not necessarily about what we've talked about today, but interesting things that are going on with different science programs and other things that's broader than what we've been talking about today.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, you know, if you had to travel to the West Coast, you'd probably have more fun at the New Space Conference, but AIAA would probably, given your mix of technology and wanting to network with people, would probably open you up to a lot of new opportunities.
Yeah, yeah. I want to hit that one, too. I was actually out in Anaheim at that time. I was on a family trip to Disneyland.
Oh, you should have come over to at least part of it.
Maybe I should have flipped out, you know, at some point from the Pirates of the Caribbean and poked my head in.
And come to the Pirates of the Space Community. I don't know where it's going to be in 2011, but I think it's a key and an important conference. It's also very, very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
But you're media, so you'll get a media pass.
You know, it's interesting. This conference I'm going to next week is the very first time I've just gone as myself, without representing a particular magazine or publication. And that's actually quite cool. You know, I Now I can just really hone in on what I'm really interested in and not have to.
I go as the space show, but that is me. So,
right.
You know, that's like we were talking about earlier. Bigelow and Elon are their company visions and missions. And so, you know, that's the way I am integrated, one and the same with the space show.
And that's I think it's where media is moving, too. And I think that's where the readers and followers go, too, because of those passionate people who are very focused on things that interest them. And I'm really looking forward to making that more a part of what I do.
Well, let me tell you, new media is really where the action is. If you want to get news about what's happening in Egypt or in the world or Iran or whatever, new media is the action point. And with more and more of new media coming to smartphones and more people realizing, you know, how much power they have in a device the size of a Zippo cigarette lighter.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. The risk there, and I just did a program the other night with Baron, you probably know too, Baron Zocca, on the risk of the internet being regulated and our freedoms to do what we want with it taken down. And I'm just reading now where Verizon is traffic managing, you know, their system partially because of the iPhone that's been such a big hit. They sold out in 24 hours of the Verizon version of the iPhone. And they're putting broadband caps on their network. And some of the reports from CNET and the others are talking about this because they need to manage how much traffic is going to happen because of the, the iPhone. But they're saying the top 5% data users are going to be curtailed. So this is what everybody really has to be vigilant against. And new media is the salvation of humanity, as far as I'm concerned. And look, in Egypt, what they do, they killed cell phones and they killed the internet.
Right. That was one of the first things they did.
Yeah. And this is how we stay connected and we know what's going on. And more people are coming into the new media world to get their information. And whether it's about space or technology or medicine or whatever, you know, your interest may be, we really cannot afford to see new media regulated. And yeah, there's a total amount of crap in new media. And this is why I talk about people need to learn discernment and critical thinking so you can determine what's garbage and what is probably real.
Right. But, and, you know, I'm excited, too, about the interactive element to get feedback from readers.
Oh, yeah, unbelievable, even on the iPhones and everything, on the smartphones. You know, it's an amazing world that we're moving into, and I can imagine that governments and the status quo feel really threatened by how much information we can access and how much power we can have as individuals as well as collective members of society by being able to tap into more power and more information than what's in the Library of Congress, except we don't have to be there and fill out a card to get in. Unbelievable.
Amazing.
Absolutely. Michael, I hope we cross paths soon. If you are going to come out to one of the California conferences or something like that, please let me know. I you know what would be really fun is to do a joint technology space show with the two of us hosting it together and venture into some world with some people out here doing some advanced cutting-edge energy technology. I know NASA Ames is supporting a lot of people doing that. Pete Warden has a whole list of people. I mean, if you wanted to do that and you were out here, we could put on a jointly hosted space show and go talk to some of these alternative energy people in the Bay Area that are at the forefront of doing a lot of this stuff.
Oh, yeah, you're right in the middle of it there. Yeah.
I mean, it would probably be all on tape. I doubt that we'd be able to muster it up as a live show. But we could have a 30-minute segment with this person or that person and just do it jointly. We'd have a ball.
Yeah, it sounds like. Yeah, I would take you up on that.
So if you're out here, let me know, and I'll see if I can draw on Pete to connect us to some of the people that Ames is supporting and if we could pull off something like that.
Okay. I'm going to be speaking at a conference next month with the head of SRI. So,
Are you going to be out at Stanford in Palo Alto?
No, we're kind of meeting up in the middle. Well, not, I guess, more his way. We're going to be out in Arizona and Phoenix.
Okay.
Area. But I'm really looking forward to picking his brain about what's going on. And you know, of course, SRI was the second node on the internet. And,
right.
And invented HDTV and robotic surgery. And
of course, you might want to go to the founder of the internet and talk to Al Gore. He's now in Santa Barbara.
Right.
You know, find out how all this global warming is causing such freezing weather. That, you know, his website crashed on that, but I'm sure he has good details on that.
Yeah, well, who knows? I'm looking at about 2 feet of snow out the window right now. We just got hammered on the East Coast.
Well, listen, stay warm, and I look forward to doing more programming with you in 2011.
Thank you, me too.
Take care. Thank you very much. And listeners, that's it, Dr. Joan Johnson Fries on military, national security, defense, space, policy, and more is with us on Sunday for the very first time. I'm really looking forward to talking to her, and I hope you all tune in and listen to that as well. On behalf of Michael Belfiore and myself in the Space Show, goodbye, everyone. Have a great weekend.